Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Andrea Medich. She is the executive producer of the film that's opening this weekend at the Center for Contemporary Arts, Encounters at the End of the World, a film about Antarctica. Right now, I'd like to welcome Ana Mariela Bachigalupo, and she is a professor at the State University of New York at Buffalo. She's a summer scholar at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe, and she's the author of the book Shamans of the Foye Tree, Gender, Power, and Healing Among the Chilean Mapuche. And she will be speaking today, Thursday, from 5 to 6 in the afternoon at Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Now, this is such an interesting book, Shamans of the Foye Tree. First of all, what is the role of the shaman or machi for the Mapuche society in Chile?
One of the main roles of the shaman is basically to heal people in the community, to use herbal remedies and spirits and in order to intervene on behalf of people in the community, things like soul loss, stress, unhappiness, failure, scarcity, drought, a number of different things. It's really to intervene between the people in the community and the spirits.
So tell us a little bit about the Mapuche people. What are their communities like, and how have they both retained their indigenous identities and changed as a result of Spanish colonialism?
There are about 1.2 Mapuche in Chile today. 1.2 million Mapuche today, and about 80% of them live in Santiago, which is the capital of Chile. The rest of them live on reservations in the south of Chile. These are rural communities, which are sort of spread out households and so on. But really, the rural communities in the south remain a really important signifier in terms of symbolism. It remains the imagined homeland. So even if you have people that are working in the city and living in the city, they definitely identify the south of Chile, the rural communities, as their place of origin, as their homeland, as their original territory.
And so, in some sense, I mean, I suppose it's analogous to urban Indians and reservation Indians in the United States and in New Mexico.
Yes, it's very similar.
So you're an anthropologist, and you also got involved with the Mapuche shamans as a friend and as a client, and presumably they've been studied by anthropologists before, and they probably say, oh boy, here come the anthropologists. What was your relationship like with them?
Well, I have a really long relationship with them. I've been working with them over 15 years now, and my first contact with Mapuche was with the Mapuche in Argentina, where my grandparents had a farm. So basically the first time I went to a ritual, I was about 5 years old. So I really have a close relationship with the Mapuche community that really spanned two sides of the border. They moved from and between Chile and Argentina, like we could go from Santa Fe to Albuquerque. So that was my first contact with them. And
now, was there an indigenous language that you picked up as a child?
They speak Mapudungun, a mixture between Mapudungun and Spanish, or, Mapungududasized Spanish or Spanified Mapudungun is what people actually speak in the communities today. So it's a mixture. It's like Spanglish in some ways.
And also, like in Peru, in like Cusco, you have this Quechua-influenced Spanish and vice versa.
Exactly.
And so you grew up sort of very naturally seeing these were you actually watching healing rituals as a kid?
No, not healing rituals, but I did participate in collective fertility rituals at that point. And what happened is one of the people that worked in my grandparents' farm had a brother who worked in Chile who was the community chief. And when I decided to do some work in Chile, he said, well, come on over, stay with me. And he was the butcher of the community as well as being the community chief, which was very important because in all rituals you need meat. And so therefore I met many, many shamans through him.
Now, were you already an anthropologist by this point?
When I became an anthropologist, I started working with him in Chile, yes, but throughout my childhood, I used to spend every summer in Argentina. So I had relationships with people there. A lot of the Chileans, the communities where I worked, actually went to Argentina every summer to work on the farm. So I met a lot of the people that I met later in Chile in Argentina during the summers.
So what is the specific nature of the shamanic work? How do they do it? I mean, a surgeon takes a knife and cuts you open and takes out the bad thing, and sews you back up. How do these shamans work?
What they do is they divine illnesses mainly through urine samples. They look at a urine sample and they'll say, what are the physical components of the illness? What are the emotional aspects of the illness? Which are the spiritual aspects of the illness, by looking at a urine sample or by drumming over a piece of used clothing. Those are the ways in which they divine an illness. And once they've made that divination, they usually give the patient, you know, bottles of herbal remedies made from boiling herbal remedies together for their specific ailment. And once they've completed drinking all these herbal remedies, then they will have rituals, usually all-night healing rituals, in which you have drumming, entering into altered states of consciousness and contacting spirits in order to heal the person, find out what the situation is, why this problem, this person got ill, and how to solve that. So there's always a physical aspect to it. There's always massaging with herbal remedies and so on. There's a spiritual aspect of this. You've made some sort of major transgression to the spirit world, and we need to fix that. Maybe you're possessed by an evil spirit and so on. And there's also an emotional component to that and a social one. You know, you're fighting with your family members. You've transgressed social norms in the community and so on. So it's a very holistic type of healing.
And so the if you were to just take the herbs, that wouldn't be enough.
No, although they do have these, they created these Mapuche pharmacies nowadays where you can get just the herbs, but, you know, the shamans definitely say that's not enough, and most people would agree that, you know, it isn't enough. It's just a little more expensive to do the ritual as well.
So the subtitle of the book is Gender, Power, and Healing Among the Chilean Mapuche. So let's talk about that. First of all, the healers are both male and female.
That's right.
And so, to what extent do their gender roles in ordinary society differ from the rest of the community?
Well, in their everyday roles, they're somewhat similar to men and women. What really differs them is that in ritual context, both men and women take on male, female, and then co-gender identities, which is a combination of the masculine and the feminine in one role. And they switch from and between these different identities. They have to dress in women's clothing, women's scarves, women's silver jewelry in order to seduce the spirit. That is, men do too. So men are transvestite, women shamans are not. And there's a lot of idea of, you know, femininity being associated with spirituality, with healing, and then masculinity being associated with exorcism, with, you know, eliminating evil spirits, with, you know, defeating unhappiness and so on.
So a real warrior type of thing.
Exactly. And the issue is that these elements, they don't translate exactly, you know, into everyday life. When you have all this very complex gender shifting and ritual, the idea is that some of that complexity is going to remain in that person's everyday life, in the shaman's everyday life. So they're considered exceptional men and women in every regard. You know, so for example, you know, first of all, women are considered married to the spirits. That's first and foremost their
identity. So they don't marry?
They do marry, but every time they have you know, sex with their husbands, they have to ask for forgiveness for the spirits. They, you know, they have to be primarily, you know, wives of the spirits. And so you know, a patient comes and says, we need you to heal, they'll leave husband, children, babies, and so on, and go off and heal in another community and have somebody else take on the role of mother and wife, housewife, and so on for them. So that's their primary role, is to heal. And the primary relationship is a spiritual marriage between shaman and spirit. Both men and women have that.
And so is the male shaman married to a feminine spirit?
It doesn't work that way. They're married to a spirit, and the spirit can moves from and between genders. It can be gendered differently according to context. So that doesn't really matter. The relationship is what matters, which is the relationship between bride and spirit. You know, the shaman is always the bride. The spirit is always, you know, the one who possesses or takes in charge and so on. The shaman is the one who takes on the more receptive role. And with male shamans, a lot of them nowadays don't marry, and they identify themselves as celibate Catholic priests, for example, or doctors, in order to legitimize their roles in a spiritual context, like, you know, as a priest, or in a medicinal context as a doctor, while at the same time saying, well, hey, if, you know, priests don't marry, you know, we're like priests, we don't marry for that reason, without people thinking about, you know, that maybe they're homosexual, because this is something that they're very sensitive to. They try to avoid labels of homosexuality. It's not an identity that they take on for themselves.
Now, in conversations, some of which you transcribe in the book, there are conversations in which they say, well, some of us are homosexual, some of us are heterosexual, just like priests.
They don't use those labels, homosexual and heterosexual, as much, but they do say, you know, that some, actually that was my words, they weren't
oh,
theirs,
okay.
You know, that basically they said there's variation and so on, but they don't want themselves to be labeled as homosexual. The term homosexual basically has a connotation of sorcery. is the problem. And because of...
From colonialism.
Exactly, from colonialism, because there's a huge amount of homophobia in the communities, because when colonialism came along, there was all of these tropes of sodomy, right, and witchcraft and so on, and they put those labels onto the male machi who were transvestite. So anybody who is transvestite, it was automatically viewed as homosexual. And what male shamans are doing today is they're really working really hard against those labels, because they don't want to be labeled homosexual, because then people will assume that sorcery goes hand in hand with that.
How, to what extent has Catholicism affected the way the religion is practiced? I know there are in other places, for example, in the Caribbean, there's a very thin overlay of Catholicism that once you wash it away, the pure indigenous or African religion remains.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very complex. You know, sometimes it's very superficial, other times it's very deep. You know, for example, one of my Mapuche friends said, well, you know, Jesus is actually the first shaman. And then the Spaniards killed him, right? So, I mean, there's certain appropriation of certain figures, but what Jesus means to them, of course, is very different. Or what the Virgin Mary is for them is basically an earth fertility goddess, right? So it has nothing to do with virginity, it has to do with fertility and so on. They mostly self-identify as Catholic. They're mostly baptized. They like baptismal water a lot because it renews things, it gives people life and so on. But at the same time, of course, the kind of Catholicism they practice wouldn't be something that the Pope would ever recognize.
We're talking to Ana Mariela Vatigalupo. The book is called Shamans of the Foye Tree, Gender, Power, and Healing Among the Chilean Mapuche. So gender power, what is the nature of the power that they have?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that they find, which is very important, is that the world is mapped into four different categories. That is old man, old woman, young man, and young woman. And the idea is that the older characters have wisdom, the younger characters have fertility and sexuality, and you need the masculine and the feminine parts, the masculine warring, exercising element, the feminine healing, protecting element, in order to be whole. So the idea is that shamans need to become those four beings and bring them together in order to transform a situation of illness to health, unhappiness to well-being, or to transform a situation. So basically what they're doing in any kind of healing ritual is transforming a situation. So when we're thinking about gender, it's basically about tapping into all of the hidden powers of the universe and using them in order to change situations and heal. So it's basically the most important metaphor in their healing practices.
So people who are older, people who are elders, postmenopausal women, celibate men have more power, and power is lost through sexuality.
That's correct.
Why is that?
Well, because the idea is that even though metaphors of motherhood and so on are very important, the actual physical aspect of having sex, right, or of menstruating, or of giving birth, disperse that fertile energy into children, into, you know, biological processes, rather than capturing that and using it in order to heal. So basically, the shamans who are postmenopausal, shamans who are older, and so on, can actually capture those elements, right? Those capture into those powers of fertility, the powers of creation, and so on, and use them to heal rather than, they would say, wasting them, right, in biological processes or in their everyday lives. So that's what they consider more powerful. Yeah.
It's really just energy. It's concentrated energy, life energy, expressed in a sexual way, or expressed in a shamanistic way.
Yes, it's the powers of fertility, the powers of sexuality, powers of knowledge. Knowledge is also very extremely important in this regard. Yes.
So how are the machi of the Mapuche people seen in Chile by mainstream Chileans? Are they even aware of their existence?
Well, they are today, because they appear in photo ops beside the president at the presidential palace. So
right.
It's changed radically since I first started working with the Mapuche in 1991. In 1991, a lot of people thought that they were, you know, these very traditional people of the forest who were disappearing and who would eventually in a couple of years no longer exist. Then came the passing of the indigenous law in Chile, the outcome of democracy also in the 1990s, and they've just begun proliferating because they've been recognizing their cultural practices, their medicine, their beliefs and so on have been recognized officially by Chilean society, and people have also begun to go to them for their own ailments. we have, you know, for example, on television, you have presidents who are inviting shamans to be, you know, beside them at the presidential palace, showing that they're pluralistic, showing that they want to include women, you know, barefoot woman, shaman, healer, you know, into national discourses. And the shamans, in turn, particularly the women, are extremely savvy in negotiating things for their own communities as a result, saying, well, we want more land for herbal remedies. We want to be recognized as, you know, legal healers. We want to have, you know, certain kinds of rights and so on. So they've also been very instrumental in negotiating things for the indigenous movement in Chile, particularly the Mapuche.
And there are these intercultural hospitals.
Exactly, yes. And the intercultural hospitals, you have the doctor working side by side with shamans and so on. It hasn't worked as well for some shamans because, of course, it's limited. You can't have a full-blown healing ritual at a hospital, right, with the central fire and, you know, an all-night ritual. It's just not going to work. But it does work for things such as divinations or giving basic herbal remedies and so on. And the idea behind it is good, which is that, you know, that biomedicine and holistic, you know, medicine doesn't necessarily, it's not an either-or option. You can do both of these perfectly well, and it's, you know, it works for people. And Mapuche and other people are extremely pragmatic and using different options to see, you know, what works for them. The good thing about the intercultural health hospital is that you can go with your health card and be seen by a shaman.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So, how does a person become a shaman? I mean, you tell some stories in the book about people whose their mother knew even before the child was born, but then other people come into it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's different venues. One of the most important ones is inheritance. So you could inherit it from your grandmother or your great-grandmother, and the idea is the spirits of shamans that are powerful never die. They will always be re-embodied in the bodies of new shamans, and they will keep some of their qualities, you know, their characters, their embodied performances, and so on. And then what happens is the person begins to experience things like, you know, dreams where the shaman appears, or you have dreams of a snake dancing on a sacred foyer tree, or you have, you know, dreams of this, of a horse with all this, you know, gold on it, and you're standing in still water and so on. So these very images, which are very spiritual, that appear to people. And also there's illnesses. You have boils, fevers. You know, spirits also harass people pretty severely to become shamans. So that's one of the reasons becoming a shaman is a very difficult element as well. I mean, it's not a happy one.
Right, it's not something, I mean, I think here that kind of thing is romanticized, especially in a place like Santa Fe, but it's not necessarily a happy fate.
No, I call it an initiation through divine coercion, you know, basically where the spirit harasses you until you become a shaman. And there's other ways which you can become a shaman too, is you can have visions. It's very common to have like visions in the forest where suddenly a spirit just grabs hold of you, right? And you have a vision of, again, you know, cows in still water, horses, snakes dancing on cinnamon trees, ancient shamans, and so on, auditory hallucinations with drumming, and that also can give you a shaman. And there's certain shamans that actually go and learn techniques through with another master shaman. You know, and some of them just learn through dream processes. There's different, you know, ways in which you can learn. You learn through dreams. You learn through illnesses that you get from spirits. Spirits make you ill, but at the same time teach you through that illness. And you also learn by, you know, certain shamans can say, okay, this herb is good for this particular thing, for soul loss. And this one is good for and happiness. And this one's good for your liver, and so on. And these are the techniques you need to learn through drumming. And let's practice them. So you have, you know, both of these things working simultaneously.
Now, what is your, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but what experiences of your own healing have you had through this, through the Chilean shamans?
Well, it's been a lot of things. On the one hand, I went through a severe depression at one point that they helped me with. Melanoma was one of the things that I was also went through. Yeah, and was helped with these rituals. I think a lot of it has to do with letting the shamans like show you your path. You know, where you could go after this, and having, you know, faith in the process. Again, shamans, they never say, okay, well, you can't go to the hospital because you have melanoma. They'll say, go to the hospital and then come to me.
Right.
Right, and we'll deal with this because, you know, they see things like cancer and so on as physical symptoms of emotional and spiritual problems. So they will deal with the emotional, spiritual component of that. And it was extremely effective for me for both of these things, you know, both depression and the melanoma.
Now, you are part of a new, relatively new movement in anthropology, which is participatory.
Yes.
Where you are not required to, you know, stand outside the circle with a notebook trying to achieve perfect objectivity, which doesn't exist anyway. So as a participant, what have you come to believe? I mean, I think a lot of people say, well, the spirits are just their belief system. What do you think the spirits are?
I think the spirits are a combination of different things. On the one hand, they think there's people's awareness of the spirits, that the spirits are there. You know, I think there's energies in different things, in trees, in plants, in stones, and so on, and that you're either aware or not aware of them, and it just becomes, you just become aware of that presence, and that they're articulated in particular ways in the community. Yes, I did see spirits, you know, while I was working with them. I actually was a ritual helper to two of the shamans that I worked with for a long time. And over time, in some sense, you know, by learning to suspend disbelief, was participated in that process as well. So I think spirits are also like, you know, they're a sort of visual appearance of particular problems, right? So envy, jealousy, unhappiness, and all of that can become, you know, present in the figure of the Huitranagua, which is this long thing, conquistador, you know, who seduces women and takes their blood, right? And if that image is what is prevalent in the community and you're part of that community, sooner or later you're going to see the Huitranagua and you're going to try and find ways to get away from that.
Do you see it in your dreams?
Actually, I used to dream about dogs. Dogs are mainly evil spirits, too. And when we used to go healing with this Francisca.
Dogs? Yeah. Evil?
Yeah. Francisca was this shaman who, we worked in different communities and so on. I remember one night I had this nightmare of this huge dog, you know, it was at my head, you know, and I woke up and screamed. And she goes, oh, well, that's, you know, that's the evil spirit. She goes, good thing at least you're identifying them now and so on. And now this is, we know now that the evil is present and we need to find a way to heal that. So dogs are definitely associated with evil, with the underworld. And then there's a lot of other spirits, you know, the conquistador, which is the Huitranagua's one, his wife, which is a blood-suckling, and Chimayen, you know, with blonde hair, blue eyes, and red lips, right? So there's a lot of these images of evil associated with foreignness or becoming foreign, like it's losing yourself, losing your tradition, losing your soul.
Well, there were moments in the book where you talk about, you know, you challenge their ideas about something and they say, oh, you're such a gringa.
Yeah. Well, that was mainly about ideas of say, well, I'm not a gringa, actually. I'm Peruvian and Chilean.
I know, but
anyway.
But they use that word.
Yes, they do. And that is, you know, because your identity is always changing, too, according to context. But one of the things that they would say is, for example, my ideas of homosexuality. I said, well, what's wrong with homosexuality? Why is this an issue for you? You know, I mean, what is the problem with it? And since they, you know, because of colonialism, have a very sort of negative, you know, they're very careful of that, not being labeled homosexual, then they said, oh, you're such a gringa because, you know, you accept this, right? You view this as normal. And in Chile, of course, it's still a very homophobic society, unfortunately.
Because of colonialism,
yes.
Is there a way that you can tell through your work what, you know, how the religion was practiced and what the social norms were before colonialism?
Well, I mean, I've looked back at one of the chapters, I actually look at the historical elements, where you see this term hueye, right, in the 16th century, and hueye is basically considered a person of power. And they were mainly shamans at that time, they were mainly men dressed as women, and these men dressed as women would combine spirituality, which was associated with femininity, with warfare, which was associated with masculinity, to conduct spiritual warfare against the Spaniards, that is, conduct spiritual warfare against their souls, right? And at that point, that was something that was very perfectly acceptable in Mapuche society, to the point that one time, you know, there is this Jesuit priest that arrives at a community, and the community chief answers to him, and he says, oh, there you are, father, mother, right? You know, so fantastically, you've come here to bless us, and so on. So this whole idea of the masculine and the feminine being combined in a person was viewed as very spiritual and very important, and then they projected that image onto the Catholic priest. So the same image of the shaman. So at that point, the shaman was, you know, what people consider, you know, the two spirit and so on. You know, here in the United States, was considered a very positive, powerful figure.
And I'm sure the priest didn't appreciate it so much.
Well, I don't think he understood that. He just wrote it down. I'm like, oh, okay, I know where this is coming from.
Right.
Yeah, but there was definitely that element of that positive element associated with that. And then, of course, as time goes along, they begin to incorporate some of the ideas, you know, associated with witchcraft and so on that the Spaniards brought with them. In fact, after the 16th century, in the 17th, 18th century, you actually have the predominance of women shamans. Precisely because, you know, they're not transvestite, right? They're not, I mean, nobody can see that they're doing all this gender shifting or they don't understand it, right? They view them just as traditional women. So they tend to replace the male shamans, which
were transvestite. So women don't take swords and helmets and become spiritual warriors.
They take guns. I have one Francisca who used to play, you know, to play the, you know, guns and knives. They do. They do exactly the same thing as male shamans do in ritual.
But it's still not considered transvestitism.
Well, they're not wearing men's clothes.
But they're using some of their implements.
Well, yes. But you see, the thing is that with the Spaniards, the main thing, and the Chileans too, the main issue for them is, you know, is a man dressing as a woman. They view that as transvestite. The fact that the shaman uses, you know, guns and knives and so on. First of all, they don't see that. I mean, there's very few non-Mapuche who've been admitted to healing rituals, you know, and these complex healing rituals. And second is, you know, well, they have a gun and a knife, but they don't really know, you know, that's really associated with becoming masculine, because they don't speak Mapulungu. And it's a very complex and a very secretive practice. You know, I only learned over this over many, many years of, you know, being with them, practicing, and then, you know, at the very end, being a ritual helper in these rituals. Otherwise, I wouldn't have understood what was going on either.
So here you are, you know, writing a book with the title Shamans of the Foye Tree, Gender, Power, and Healing Among the Chilean Mapuche. Very much of an academic title, you know, it's sort of the lingo of, I don't know, 80s, 90s, and 21st century academia. How did presumably the people you're writing about don't represent themselves right. in that way. Mm-hmm. How do they feel about your writing? Do they read it?
That's very interesting. This is my fourth book, right? So I've written other books. My other previous ones are all in Spanish. So yes, they have read them, and they've also used them in very unique ways. My previous book, which is La Voz del Cultrún en la Modernidad, which is the voice of the drum in modernity, they opened the pages of the book and poured wine on it to activate the prayers in the book. So, you know, they not only they read the books, but they use them actively, you know, in rituals. This book is a very, very complicated, because it deals with issues of gender and sexuality, which are used against Machi. So I haven't translated into Spanish yet. I've written up some pieces of it, which have gone into Askintua, which is this Mapuche internet newspaper. And some of it is being published in Spanish, but I'm a little wary about that, in the ways in which how it is that the Chilean media could interpret it, you know, as a way to discriminate against them. One of the Machi I talked to, I said, well, you know, what do you want to be written about? And he says, well, why don't you just say that, you know, we're all fantastic, that there's no sorcery, that we're all fantastic healers, that this is what we're doing, and, you know, give propaganda to us, because this is what we need, propaganda.
One of them wanted you to put his cell phone number.
Yeah, photograph and cell phone number in the book. And I said, well, maybe I'll put ads in the newspaper, which is what I ended up doing, you know, for that. But I can't do that in an academic book, right? You know, they want this whole need to present themselves as positively because of all of this, you know, negative sort of homophobic, you know, issues going on and ideas of sorcery. On the other hand, there were other Mapuche who said, no, you have to write about this, because this problem, this idea of homophobia, has seeped into our own communities and is undermining these roles of shamans as people who shift between gender identities, who are extremely powerful people who combine the masculine and the feminine. And by doing that, you know, by not speaking about it, you know, we're undermining our own identities. We need to come to terms with the fact that, you know, homophobia that we have as Mapuche is also affecting our traditional roles, and we need to change that. So, you know, there's different positions on in a way I should write about it.
But in any case, they're supportive, various people in different ways, but they're supportive of your writing about it.
Yes, yes. Unless they wouldn't be talking to me.
Well, that's right. They wouldn't when you think about, and again, it just brought up for me this whole question of representation. They're living their lives. You're representing it through anthropology. If you could be an artist, musician, filmmaker, anthropologist, academic, anything, how would you represent them that you think would be the most true to what they're doing and how they're living?
Well, I'm not a musicologist and I'm not an artist, so it'd be very hard for me to try and represent them in ways that I don't have, you know, I really don't have the tools to do that. I think the book is pretty true to what they want, and in all their complexity, controversy, and contradiction. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of different positions in the Mapuche communities about how they feel about these things, and that comes out in the different voices in the book. I really wanted to make sure in the book to make sure to give everybody a voice, both in terms of how I wrote about it, in terms of also how I represented them at the very end. I think, you know, it's important for their voices to come through, and that's basically why I wrote the book.
And photographs are in there as well, so we get to know the people and get to know what they look like. And much more to say about this book, but it's time to go. Ana Maria Bacigalupo is a professor at the State University of New York in Buffalo. She's a summer scholar at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. She's the author of the book Shamans of the Foye Tree, Gender, Power, and Healing Among the Chilean Mapuche. And she will be speaking today from 5 to 6 at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like right now to welcome Andrea Medich. She is executive producer of the film Encounters at the End of the World. It's a documentary film by Werner Herzog, and it opens this Friday at 8:30 at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. And Andrea will be at the screening on Saturday at 6:30. For complete listings of the showtimes, you can go to ccasantafe.org. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm delighted to be here. Nice to be here with all of you.
Now, this is an extraordinary film. It's a documentary by the German filmmaker Werner Herzog. And so it's not a National Geographic style documentary at all. It's about something else, and what it's about is very hard to put your finger on.
It is indeed. I mean, it's a real experience to go through it. Werner is a true poet. I mean, he has been making films for a remarkable number of decades now. I think he has something like 65 or 70 films. And he takes us places that we don't normally get to go. I mean, in this one, he's gone off to Antarctica with just his just a cameraman.
So two people.
Just two people. And part of the reason for that is that the access to Antarctica is so limited. You have to have a berth, and this was in conjunction with the National Science Group. So it was only the two of them. There was only room for the two of them. And they only had 5 weeks total, which is actually a very long time for a filmmaker to be given access. But because it was Werner Herzog, they said, great. And frankly, I don't think he knew what he was going to find, which is part of the journey that we go on with him, and it is quite extraordinary. You see things that you've never seen, whether you think you know what Antarctica looks like or not, you've never seen this before.
You have definitely never seen it. And while we, you know, certainly see a lot of the nature, and I don't even want to say natural beauty, because it's sort of beyond beauty, of Antarctica, we also see a lot about the people.
Yes.
Who are the people who are in Antarctica?
Yes. Well, there's some wonderful characters in this film, which Werner is a genius at finding these great characters around the world. And in getting them to talk to him and then thus to us in ways that most people can't accomplish. As a number of the characters in the film, as a number of these scientists and wanderers say, this is a point in the planet where all the lines converge, and if you shake the planet, they all end up together. And they're very much wanderers, travelers, thinkers, philosophers. There are double PhDs driving forklift trucks. My personal favorite is the Bulgarian forklift truck driver who reads Odysseus. And they give us an insight into the planet and into human nature and into the relationship between humanity and the natural world that probably none of us have ever seen before. They're extraordinary characters.
And adventurers, there was a woman there who had been on every possible adventure you can imagine.
Oh, like, the one who folds herself up in the suitcase?
Yeah, the one who folds herself up in a suitcase. She hitchhikes from Denver to, I think, Bolivia, and, you know, inside a sewer pipe on a truck.
Right.
And she gets, you know...
She gets captured by pirates at one point.
And terrorists in Uganda.
Exactly right. Exactly right. But she's a computer programmer. Let's be clear. She's down in McMurdo, programming computers and doing these crazy shows that they do down there, where she actually zips herself into a suitcase, so she is her own luggage.
Well, and that's another funny thing about it, is that there in Antarctica, there is entertainment, there are yoga classes, there are bars.
The abominations of the yoga classes.
He calls it an abomination.
Exactly. ATMs and yoga, which he doesn't like McMurdo much, but he loves the scientists. And I think one of the other great things to me about the way he deals with people is that he lets the poet in each of the scientists come out as well.
So you have
a man who's been studying icebergs, and he is in love with his iceberg, and he talks about his iceberg and shows us his iceberg and how it travels around the world and how that's affected by global warming, and also how he feels about it in a way that you don't normally hear a scientist talk about it, and actually shows us time-lapse photography that actually looks like a sonogram. I mean, it is his baby.
It does look like
a sonogram. Doesn't it? It's extraordinary. So you have people like that. You have the linguist on the one continent on the Earth that has no languages. He's actually running the greenhouse.
And that is a very odd scene as well. You go into this utterly lush greenhouse, and you feel like you're in some sort of jungle,
absolutely.
And you're in Antarctica.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You are in Antarctica. So it is a world in to itself, and it does draw these remarkable characters, the folks who are doing the underwater diving. And I think That is...
I got scared just watching mm-hmm. it.
It is frightening, isn't it? Because they go under the ice without safety lines.
A line.
And
if they can't find that hole back out,
they're gone.
Completely screwed.
And they know it. And they don't like to dive with the lines because it impedes them. And what they call... There are a number of scientists, and the person who actually got Herzog involved in this film is a wonderful alt-rock musician named Henry Kaiser, who has become an underwater diver for the Science Foundation. And he's been diving in Antarctica for many years, and it was his footage of these underwater creatures that inspired Herzog to actually go down to Antarctica and make this film.
So did the cameraman actually get into a diving suit?
Henry actually shot those. The underwater footage is Henry Kaiser, who is the producer of the film. And what they call going under the ice is going under the cathedral. So they don't want to be tethered. And part of the reason, which we experience in the film, I think, viscerally, is that it's both frightening to go under, yet there's this ambient light that's coming through the ice, and you get colors that we don't see above the ice, and you get creatures that belong on another planet. I mean, it's as close to being in science fiction as you can and still be on this planet. And there's an otherworldly quality to it that's very intense, which Henry actually was the one who paired it with some otherworldly music, which really increases this sense of being someplace else.
We're talking about the film Encounters at the End of the World with its executive producer, Andrea Medic. Well, that otherworldly music was Bulgarian.
It is Bulgarian, exactly. There's some Tuva throat music. There's some Bulgarian chants. And it has an almost atonal quality, but a hypnotic quality. And the footage is hypnotic itself. Herzog's wonderful editor, Joe Beeney, had a wonderful time working on that underwater footage, putting together to match this wonderful choral music. And there's a certain spiritual quality that comes through very strongly in this film, which is, I think, unexpected.
There's a spiritual quality to it, and it also really makes you think about the form of the documentary. And regular documentary form almost has it's sort of like the medium is the message. It has its own message. A lot of documentaries that you see today have the form, the world is in really bad shape. Mm-hmm. And here's all the terrible things that are happening, but there's a ray of hope. And
right.
And that's the documentary.
That's the formula, exactly.
This is something completely different.
I've been working on a number of films over the last couple of years, and I think they share certain qualities, and this one certainly does, and that is, we don't need to preach to people. People are very aware of what's going on in the world. What this one does is it immerses you in what Werner Herzog calls the ecstatic truth. It immerses you in a truth and lets you hear from people who are experiencing it and puts you in a place almost physically that gives you a sense of what is happening with the planet. There's no reason to. It's not education. It's immersive. It's a perspective. It's presenting you with points of view and with information. In this case, I mean, these are hard-edged scientists down there. I mean, these are men and women down there who are studying, the fat content of the Weddell seal milk. But they have, because of what their work is, they have very strong. They see patterns in the planet. And what Werner Herzog, I think, is able to do in this one is to show us the patterns of beauty and the patterns of peril.
It's not just a sort of coexistence of poetry and science. It's a melding.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a new form, I think. And I think he has always, in his very long career, has been able to pass from one side of... Some people want to make a real distinction between fiction and nonfiction. He doesn't make that distinction. And he's gotten into a lot of trouble for it. But what it has allowed him to do... I mean, when he first started out, he was doing true stories with actors, but reenacting parts of those stories. Fitzgeraldo is... We probably, many of us know, he actually had the cast dragging this entire ship over a mountain. So he actually recreated the experience for his actors.
Right.
So he made real that which he was covering in a very specific way.
And then
way.
Didn't he also make a documentary about the making of the movie?
Yeah, well, he did.
Which there added yet another layer of realness.
There are layers and layers, and now actually Werner Herzog is actually acting as Werner Herzog in some films. In the Loch Ness Monster film, he is actually playing Werner Herzog.
Right.
so that there is a, by not adhering strictly to a documentary observational truth, he in many ways gets at a much larger truth.
It brings up the very important question that I think we have only touched on this program and in other times, but it's the question of what are the questions that get asked in science, in documentary? That is not straightforward. They're human questions. It's human beings coming up with the questions. Mm-hmm. And the questions that he raises, you know, what is important about Antarctica? Mm-hmm. Well, the forklift driver and the very strange single-celled creatures.
Yes.
And the, you know, the volcano.
Yes.
And the lava.
With the bombs,
thing,
lava bombs.
Yeah,
flying
and the
out.
Fact that they're called lava bombs.
That's
and
right.
That we use language to describe these things.
That's
that
right.
Has a, you know, all of those things are what's important, and all of those things represent a whole different set of questions than we're used to asking.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. That one of the interesting things about Herzog, and certainly comes through in this film, is he doesn't ask the typical journalists or documentarians questions. He's asking things like, are there insane penguins?
Right. And then you see one.
So he doesn't, we're in many ways all stuck on surface questions.
Yeah.
We're stuck on, is there global warming? Well, we actually don't need to ask that question. We need to talk to the man who studies the icebergs and see how they float in ocean currents, and hear what he has to say about that, rather than asking those big, broad questions, which are essentially didactic questions. So I think Werner gets us under the skin in a way that most people don't.
And it also, it brings up this whole set of issues of when you have encounters with beauty and I hate to say truth and beauty, but you know, in a film like this, there you have it. It affects the way you act, and it affects the way you think about the next thing, mm-hmm. in a totally different way than if you see a didactic, what would you call it, you know, activist film mm-hmm. telling you, mm-hmm. you must now all call your senators.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are a number of us who believe that there are ways that you can get at very important issues, but in ways that provoke and entertain and do not take a sort of holier-than-thou point of view, that reveal to you what you see as the truth. And also, again, in Werner Herzog's film, and certainly in Encounters, he puts himself in the film. He's the narrator. So you know his point of view. If you don't agree with it, that's fine, but he's laid it out there for you. And I think that the kinds of specifics, he's also somebody, and this is, I mean this metaphorically as well as literally, he lets the camera run. And he lets people move into another space where they can talk about what they're doing, or you can see what they're doing when they cease to be aware of the camera. And I think that's important as well.
We're talking to Andrea Medic about the film Encounters at the End of the World, a film about Antarctica. There's an interesting moment where they go to Shackleton's original dwelling.
Hmm.
Which has been there since I don't even remember what the dates of...
It's about 100 years ago.
It's about 100 years, years ago. And also brings up a very interesting thing, which is that this was really the end of the British Empire going to the end of the world.
Absolutely.
And realizing that this was as far as you could go, and it just started to decline after that.
Well, that's a very interesting part, because as with all of Werner's films, there's a metaphorical element to this. Because what you see in that completely preserved Shackleton's shack is the exportation of the British Empire. You
right.
see cans of tinned beef.
Right.
You see, I mean, things that you, you know, don't necessarily want to eat in the end of the world. But it was an attempt to mold Antarctica to an existing empire. And I think that's what his problem is with McMurdo and sort of the overlay of what's going on, that there's an uglification. Although he's not into just sort of the beauty of the natural world like a lot of folks are. But there's an uglification where we're trying to put our own stamp on this land, but that the land continues to exist in its own right, and that what he's doing is talking to people who have a respect for that and an understanding of that we then achieve.
I did find myself while watching it, and because the human element is so present in the film, and the forklifts and these just hideously ugly buildings and so on, I did find myself, you know, with great respect to the work of science and its importance, wondering if we might not actually learn more by just leaving it alone.
It's an interesting thought. And I think there is a new understanding. I do think that there is an emerging understanding. To some extent, you have to immerse yourself in the landscape, and it's such a hard landscape to live in. I mean, one of the truly humorous scenes in the film is the bucket brigade, where they actually put big plastic buckets on everybody's heads when they first get there to teach them how to function in a whiteout. It's a very harsh place. Somehow, we learn more by being up close to the volcanic bombs. We learn more by being at the point where they're taking milk from the Weddell seals, and we see the thickness of it. Can we leave the planet alone and still understand it, and can we understand our impact on it without being close to it at a certain point? I think that's a tough call.
It's a tough call, and I felt myself, I mean, you know, we've been dissecting. I mean, I dissected frogs in the ninth grade or whatever, but I started to feel, you know, what happens when you take away the seal's milk? What happens to that particular seal and to that seal community? How are they affected by it?
I think one of the things that does come through, though, is you hear from those scientists, which is that they're very concerned about how that seal is responding. And it may disturb us in some ways, but I think the scientists are taking into account that there are certain populations that it's easier to study. Other people may be going to have a different point of view.
And the thing that's great about the film is it brings up those thoughts in a very gentle and, as you said, non-didactic way that you can go home with and probably have a lot of conversations with after
the film
is done.
I hope so, because it's a very provocative film. I mean, it really gets into all kinds of issues. And I think one of the ones that was the most surprising to many of us when we were beginning the film was that there is this quality of this, again, melding of science and spirituality that's, again, most unexpected and will touch people in different ways. There are scenes where they're going into what they call the fumaroles, which are these great gas chambers that are created when the volcano sends up its heated gases through the ice. And it creates these crystal caves. And we get to go in these crystal caves. And it's not something that most of us would ever see. And to see how these are formed is remarkable.
So you are one of the executive producers on this film. What is your role in producing a film like this?
In this case, for Encounters, I was the person who helped develop the idea. I mean, I had worked with Werner Herzog and the rest of the team, the producer at Creative Differences, on Grizzly Man, and wanted to continue the relationship. And in fact, when we were working on Grizzly Man, was when we all found Henry Kaiser, who did some of the music for Grizzly Man, and saw this footage of Antarctica. So helped get Werner access to the National Science Foundation through Discovery Communications, which I was working at that time. So we could sort of give the Discovery imprimatur to get him on the boat, get him a berth. And then it was a matter of waiting. There's darkness for five weeks when they're out there. When he comes back, he works very fast. So it's a matter of working with him in terms of direction, and also then making sure that it's, you know, going to work for a larger audience, helping to sell it. It is going to be released. It is being released theatrically, so I will also participate then in getting a buyer for it so that it could be seen in theaters.
But we can see it right now, ladies and gentlemen, starting this Friday at 8:30 at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Andrea Medich, executive producer of Encounters at the End of the World, will be there on Saturday at the screening at 6:30. There are many more screenings, and you can find them at all the different show times at ccasantafe.org or call 982-1338. Andrea Medich, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today, and welcome back, Laurel. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, on Good Morning Jazz, pianist Mark Copeland will pay a visit. That and much, much more here on KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station, broadcasting live broadcasting, not live, but recording at the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Friday, Robert Knott. We'll see you then. Hasta la vista. Ciao.